Good evening, Nighthawks listeners. Tonight, we have a special episode for you from the Nighthawks Lost and Found Department. This one is going to be just a little different, because frankly, it's not an episode of the Nighthawks podcast. What you're about to hear is a slightly retooled pilot episode of a podcast that was pitched for a regional Wyoming news brand by Matt and myself. To borrow a turn of phrase from Matt that he used in a previous episode where he borrowed it from somewhere else, it was just a matter of running it up the flagpole and the wind not blowing that day. Things just did not move forward with this. What you're about to hear was pitched under the title of the Jackalope Drive-In. It was going to be a region-specific podcast incorporating tourist destinations and attractions around the state of Wyoming through the lens of movies that had ties to the state. We do tease future episodes, and indeed, we did have a pretty cool list running, but for right now, there are no active plans to produce the Jackalope Drive-In as it was originally planned in a limited series run. Never say never. There is no reason we couldn't cannibalize some of these pitched episodes to eventually be covered on Nighthawks, but that's a conversation for the future. In the meantime, check out the Nighthawks podcast, 130 episodes strong, on the podcatcher of your preference. You can find us on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Audible, Amazon Music, Spotify, just a host of others. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and at nighthawkspodcast.com. In the weeks to come, you can look forward to our coverage of The Matrix Resurrections with a special guest in studio, that coming soon to a podcast RSS near you. Also, Matt and I have been doing some moonlighting on the oneofus.net family of podcasts, specifically for Screener Squad, so be sure to check out some of our contributions over there with the wonderful rotating panel of personalities at the oneofus.net podcast ranch. With formalities out of the way now, here is a new twist on a movie that we did cover on the Nighthawks podcast originally way back on episode 33. This is an episode on Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Some of this will be review if you heard that episode 5 years ago, but there is a lot of new stuff in here for you to enjoy. Welcome to the Jackalope Drive-In Podcast, the podcast that discusses the few and magical times where Wyoming, the cowboy state, and Hollywood's Tinseltown came together.
That probably brings us to what we're here to do today. For this special limited series podcast, we'll be taking you through several films that have some kind of connection to Wyoming, be it setting or some kind of historical significance. Some of the movies were filmed here, some of them were set here, and some of them used the state to double for places that aren't Wyoming. I'm one of your co-hosts, stand-up comedian and film critic Matt Foster.
And I'm film critic Trevor T. Trujillo. And for this trip to the Jackalope Drive-In, we're going to be discussing one movie that partly takes place in Wyoming, but wasn't filmed here. That's the classic and rebellious Western from 1969, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Paul Newman is Butch Cassidy, and the Sundance Kid is Robert Redford. Catherine Ross is Etta Place.
Dynamite's ready, Butch.
Well, that ought to do it.
Think you used enough dynamite there, Butch?
Most of this is true, and all of it blazes with action. You've never met a pair like Butch and Sundance.
Well, we're back in business, boys and girls.
Outlaws with style, in a class all their own.
You know, when I was a kid, I always thought I was going to grow up to be a hero.
Don't tell me how to rob a bank. I know how to rob a bank.
And anything you ask of me, I'll do. Except one thing. I won't watch you die.
You just keep thinking, that's what you're good at.
An incredible pair of rugged adventurers, creating a living legend on two continents.
But it's just one guy.
Don't you get sick of being right all the time?
They robbed trains.
Stop it.
Looted banks.
Manos Arriba.
They got him up.
Ah, you're so damn smart, you read it.
And one girl shared their love and larceny.
Raindrops keep falling on my head. And just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed. Nothing seems to fit. Those raindrops are falling on my head.
What are you doing?
Stealing your woman?
Take her.
Boy, you're a romantic bastard, I'll give you that.
Then, Mr. E.H. Harriman of the Union Pacific put the top lawmen in the West on their trail.
They're very good!
If he just pay me what he's spending to make me stop robbing him, I'd stop robbing him.
If you haven't seen Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, we should probably warn you, we'll be talking about the movie in full, including the ending. It is a decades-old movie about events that were over 100 years ago at this point. But if it's something you'd like to see fresh without us ruining it for you, this would be a good time to stop and watch it. It's available on several of your streaming options.
We're also big supporters of public libraries and the interlibrary loan programs they're in. This is probably a title that your local library or one of their partners is going to have, so please check with them if you can. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is a film from director George Roy Hill, who also worked on some films that our listeners might be familiar with, like Thoroughly Modern Millie, starring Mary Tyler Moore, Slaughterhouse-Five, based on the Kurt Vonnegut novel, and another Paul Newman, Robert Redford outing, The Sting, from 1973.
You can't hear it, but I'm tapping my nose. The writer on this film was the legendary William Goldman, a two-time Oscar-winning writer, who gave us films like All the President's Men, the 75 adaption of The Stepford Wives, A Few Good Men with Cruise and Nicholson, and the incredibly quotable Princess Bride. He wrote all those movies? That's inconceivable.
You keep using that word. I do not think it means what you think it means.
Just to remind the audience at home, since it's probably been a while since these things happened to them, the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is the heavily fictionalized story of the two legendary outlaws toward the end of their criminal careers. After the approach of technology makes U.S. frontier banks a little too hot to handle, the robbers embark on several daring train heists, but the payroll they steal proves to be a step too far for the people who own the railroad, who hire an elite group of trackers and lawmen to hunt down and kill the pair. After a chase all the way across Wyoming and beyond, Butch and Sundance decide to make a go of practicing their trade down south in the South American country of Bolivia, where they encounter a whole new batch of problems.
What's your history with this film? Is this one that's well watched for you?
I'm going to open the parasocial window here and transgress. This is my mother's probably single favorite film. I'll put it this way. I've been in the house when this was on quite a few times. I don't suppose that for every one of those outings that I sat down and watched the whole thing, but I have to have seen this 20 times.
And this is one that I go back to a lot. I think I came to it probably in my mid-20s, a little later than I probably should have. Some of the events that are represented in the film actually did take in history, and that happened in our backyard. And so the fact that it did take me so long to come to this is kind of embarrassing. But ever since then, I watch it about once every couple of years just because it's a good movie. I really enjoy watching it. That being said, Matt, how did it leave you on this particular viewing? We watched it just before recording the episode.
I think that, like, in light of when it was shot, right, there's a few devices in it that clunk a little today. There's a couple of montages in it that are sort of handled with the old style, like, whirling montage of stills and posters. And there are, once they get to Bolivia, there are a couple of bank heists in Bolivia that are super charming. Like, there's one where the Sundance Kid and his love interest pose as a rich couple. The bank manager gives them a tour and takes them all the way down into the vault and opens the safe for them to show them how sturdy it is. And only then does Sundance take out his sidearm and stick the guy up. Those are presented very quickly. Like, they're edited for time because they got into the last third of the movie. As neat as some of the stuff is where they're being chased on horseback across the West, I would almost rather see those play out as fully dialogued scenes. But I'm nitpicking. I mean, I liked it. Plays good and it replays well.
Yeah, and you know, I always seem to find something new, something different to gravitate towards on each respective view. It has a lot of rewatchability value. We were joking a little bit off mic how this has Lurch in color, and this is the first time I ever put together that Harve Logan, otherwise known as Kid Curry from Wyoming history, in this film is played by a very large and imposing actor.
Ted Cassidy, isn't it? Isn't that the irony?
Yeah, you're right.
Cassidy being an alias that Butch Cassidy selected voluntarily. Kind of funny that was his actual... I'm explaining the joke.
But yeah, he was Lurch in the 1960s Addams Family television series. That was kind of neat. He calls out Butch Cassidy at one point. They have a little memorable duel. But when he's calling him out, I'm like, God, I know that voice. Why do I know that? And I had to look him up, and lo and behold, it's Lurch from the Addams Family. But I think, Matt, you hit on something as to why this movie just resonates with me so well, is just the whole thing is so dang charming for most of it. Now, this movie takes a really dark turn in the final act, and we'll get to that in a bit. But otherwise, Newman and Redford are just on the ball here. Paul Newman plays Butch Cassidy. Robert Redford plays the Sundance Kid. They have a real witty repartee going back and forth. The script is skillfully written by William Goldman. He's a legendary writer. And they're just super likable, and for being villains, you know, they're essentially bad guys. They're taking money that isn't theirs. But the movie presents them as these really charming, funny Robin Hood characters.
I think what's interesting about it, some of the more exaggerated stuff that I assume was fictional was actually real, and some of the more mundane stuff where they're kind of like being cool guys was more fictionalized to make them into kind of even more Robin Hood figures.
Mm-hmm.
Technically speaking, most of this movie was filmed around Mount Zion National Park in Utah. It takes place mostly in Wyoming.
Yeah, the front half of this movie takes place largely in Wyoming and in the area of Hole in the Wall, which is a little north of us here in Casper. They also filmed in areas of Colorado, California, and New Mexico.
Okay, and so the real Butch and Sundance kind of went all over, right? They went where the quote-unquote work was?
Yeah, that's right. But both men do have specific ties to Wyoming, including both of them serving time here. For instance, the Sundance Kid, who is played by Robert Redford in the film, was originally born Harry Longbaugh in Pennsylvania in 1867. He gained his nom de crime after, in 1887, he allegedly stole a horse, a gun, and saddle from a ranch outside of a Wyoming community by the name of Sundance, which still exists in Crook County. He was ultimately captured by authorities and sentenced to 18 months there. And while incarcerated, Longbaugh would adapt the name Sundance.
Butch did his time in Wyoming as well. I believe the only time he was ever actually incarcerated was a facility located in Laramie, Wyoming, which is still there today, has a museum in it.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, to help us tell Butch's story, we actually have a little help today, Matt.
My name is Deborah Cease. I am the site superintendent at the Wyoming Territorial Prison State Historic Site.
Now, Matt, I know it's been a while since either of us have darkened the pavement in Laramie, but since we were last there, the museum has installed a great exhibit to Butch Cassidy.
So when we're talking historical accuracy of the Butch and Sundance story, there's some things that did happen, some that probably happened a little different from the way they're presented on the screen. For the most part, a lot of the exploits of Redford and Newman's version of Sundance and Butch are fictionalized. Deborah helped us kind of parse what was real and what was made up for the movie, especially as regards to Butch.
I think the film is really, it's the way that they kept the legend alive. The story of Butch Cassidy is just not contained in historical documents and newspaper accounts. Today, Butch is immortalized in music and literature and films and festivals, and even on TV shows. It's all perpetuating the Cassidy legend, and that all derived from the Wild West shows of the 19th century, the end of the late 19th century, because Americans wanted that adventure in the Wild West, and Hollywood has been fascinated with the Wild West for many years, and it produced many mythical, larger-than-life lawman and outlaw films. Butch Cassidy was no exception. Hollywood embraced Butch as the ultimate hero outlaw in that 1969 movie, Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. It was a good movie. It won 4 Academy Awards. And in 2003, I don't know if you know, the film was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant. It does have a strong cultural presence. But the Butch that they represented in that movie, Butch didn't ride a bicycle. The Butch that ended up in this prison was a completely different gentleman. Butch was larger than life during his life and also the many years after and since. He arrived here at our prison. He actually arrived here in 1894. His exploits between 1879 and 1894 are hazy. He was involved with a lot of horse thievery and cattle rustling and a couple of small bank robberies, mining payroll robberies. But he hit a patch of bad luck when he bought a stolen horse from his rustler friend, Billy Nutcher, in Fremont County in Wyoming, and he was caught with that stolen horse. So he got sentenced to 2 years here at the Wyoming prison. Ironically, he was pardoned by the governor, the Wyoming governor, in January of 1896. I think this is why Butch has this following of being a Robin Hood or this hero outlaw type thing. He was very charismatic. He was quick to laugh. He had a sense of humor, but he knew how to kind of manipulate people too. But people liked him. The people that petitioned the governor of Wyoming was the actual judge that put him there in prison in the first place. He had people that signed this petition. So like Judge Knight was the one that put him there. The sheriff and deputy sheriff of Fremont County, a state senator, the mayor of Lander, a Lander city council person, all wanted to pardon George Cassidy, because that was his name, his alias he was going by, was George Cassidy. And because he was liked, you know, by so many people. Contemplating the granting of the pardon, though, Governor Richards clearly thought that Cassidy might be a good citizen if he was just given a chance. And he stated, this is what he said, "The only question in this matter is my judgment whether Cassidy would do as he is expected to do, because I truly believe Cassidy could be a leader of great men." Well, the pardon didn't have the desired effect, because when he left, you know, Cassidy was a leader of great men. Unfortunately, it was men called the Wild Bunch. So, you know, he becomes America's most wanted. So he did become a leader of great men. He did a lot. They handled a lot of territory called the Outlaw Trail. The Outlaw Trail ran basically, and Butch wasn't the only one that quote-unquote used the Outlaw Trail. It ran from about the middle of Montana all the way down to Arizona and New Mexico, through Wyoming, Colorado, all that. The reason he chose Wyoming was because of the geography of the land. Butch was brilliant in planning robberies because Butch used the landscape in order to disappear. He would go, he would check out a job, you know, robbing a bank or a train. Then he would peruse the landscape, find hiding holes, put horses there for relay horses. If the posse comes after them, then they would change horses out and continue on, you know, their path. They would hide in places like Brown's Park and Hole in the Wall and all of these other places to hide out from the posses. So he used the land very strongly. And let's face it, if you've been to Wyoming, there's a lot of places to hide.
So the film is not a great historical aid, and if you're a school-age student and you're writing a report on Butch and Sundance and you base it off the movie, you're probably going to get points from Moxie, but you'll be downgraded for accuracy. But what about this movie works? Why is it lionized the way it is?
I have a personal theory. I think that what helps this play is the exact time that it's set at. Even though this is a relatively lighthearted movie for most of the screen time, like they're quipping and they're joking back and forth, a lot of genuine comedy in this, I think part of what keeps them from coming across as villains is the idea that they're like the last of a dying thing. Like the movie sells this with like some of the music choices, and so like the initial music here is very nostalgic, and it's very clear that the clock is going to beat these guys if they don't find something else to do. In the end, you're kind of rooting for them to find a way to retire, and it doesn't quite go down that way. Primarily, I think the movie just chugs along on the strength of Redford and Newman. I mean, they could all but kick kittens, and you'd still root for them. Yeah. Or what was it? Newman says that in the movie. He says, "If you help me out with this, I'll get you a dog to kick." to one of the.
Well, and Catherine Ross is at a place too. She's just fantastic in this. Yeah, Ed has been theorized to be several people, but at the end of the day, just like Butch and Sundance, there's just a big question mark over a lot of her life.
I think that's part of what makes this a great era to set things in. What's the line at the end of Unforgiven? He prospered in dry goods after relocating. Like, you think about a rest home, and I was just listening to the Ballad of Poncho and Lefty for some mood music, and it of course ends with the survivor Lefty in an old age home in Ohio. Maybe it was a cheap hotel, I don't know, but he survives into the 40s. You just think about that era, like after the Civil War, like how many people would have just been looking to just drop out and forge a new life, and how, you know, between that and the warfare that preceded it and followed it, and that gets us to like the Pinkertons and some of the stuff and the train and coal strike eras, where like all these things were just settled through violence in the American frontier. And how life got pretty cheap there for a while, and identity was pretty cheap. Like, you could just go three towns over and be like, I'm Jeb Smith, I'm a Lutheran, I can bend a horseshoe, and all of a sudden just be a resident of this new town. Do you think we romanticize that to deal with how bad it actually was? Or do you think it's more like it has the things that are necessary to be romanticized, like that fluidity?
You know, I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's that, all of the above. And, you know, part of what I think makes this movie work is it's almost an indictment of that genre. It's almost an anti-Western, because we start off with a sepia tone. Sundance is gambling, a guy in a saloon, he's having a good run of luck. They accuse him of cheating. He pulls his gun, he shows off. It's a very standard tropey Western scene. And then they go in and case a bank and see that the bank is super locked down, super secure. They're using a brand new safe. It's a brand new bank. Butch Cassidy asks the bank guard, what happened to the old bank? The old one was beautiful. He said, well, it got robbed too many times. And so immediately we then set off on this alternate Western with these two guys, these very charismatic characters who are trying to cling and grasp onto that last vestige of what you're talking about, Matt, this era where you could get away with stealing and Robin Hooding across the American frontier. And the dark turn that we talk about in this movie is when that all comes to a crashing halt and things start playing for keeps in Bolivia. They end up on the other side of the law, having not been terribly successful with their bank robberies, and they're actually ushering a payroll for money. They get set upon by bandits, and then that ends up ending with Butch Cassidy having to take a life, which in the parlance of the film was something that he had not done before. And after that, the movie gets real somber, and you realize that the jig is up for these two guys, and that this is actually a tragic story. This is an American tragedy.
Well, yeah, and in terms of the progression, like, because we had the very sincere Westerns of the 40s and 50s, what's interesting to me, again, if you think about the longevity of the people involved, right? The oldest people watching John Wayne movies had participated in the events depicted. And if you think about, like, the youth, the like, we think of the movie industry as, like, this American juggernaut. And the fact is, movies with sound are only, what, 100 years old? There were people watching Cheyenne that had ridden in a stagecoach. And then you got this generation of, I don't know if I would call Butch and Sundance an anti-Western, but it's sort of an inflection point. And then it was off into the exploitation, like the spaghetti Westerns. And then after the spaghetti Westerns, of course, came the darker and grittier, like the modern Western, like Unforgiven and...
Sure, 3:10 to Yuma remake, True Grit remake. There's no other Western that's going to put their lead on a bicycle with the other lead's girlfriend to a Burt Bacharach song. You know, you're just not going to see that in any other Western, and you see it here. And I think it's very intentionally trying to subvert those tropes that were set up in the Golden Age Westerns, the John Wayne Westerns.
There's just the faintest hint of like an emotional triangle here. They never cheat, but it's almost like Butch is more the friend and Sundance is the lover. Even the bicycle itself is kind of, well, it's an automatic horse. So it's got that little trace of like they're going over the hill whether they want to or not, which is also when Sundance is showing off and trying to intimidate his way out of being accused of cheating at cards. That's what Butch says to him. He says this might be the time, Sundance. You might be over the hill. It happens to everybody. Time is a law. But they manage it with some of this really great comedy. I don't think you can have a complete discussion of Butch and Sundance without talking about the moment where they over dynamite the train.
I love that scene. And I think that's I think part of the longevity of this movie is just the fact that you can say that about this movie. You can say, oh, the scene where they do this, the scene where they rob the bank in Bolivia, the scene where they ride the bicycle, the scene where they use too much dynamite on the safe.
The scene where they jump from the cliff.
The scene where they jump from the cliff. It's one of those things that the movie actually got partially right, Matt. Those train robberies with the same guy behind the door and the overuse of dynamite, that all happened. Now, it may not have happened as it does in the movie, but as a matter of fact, you can see an example of a safe that was blown in a similar manner at the Frontier Prison in Laramie.
See, that was one of the things that I assumed was kind of overplayed, but apparently there is this safe that exists that is a blown safe, but is it the blown safe?
We are very, very, very fortunate to have been given us a safe that was discovered in the Wilcox area where the famous Wilcox train robbery happened.
Once again, here's Deborah Cease.
We don't have definitive proof that it is the safe. However, here's what we do know. The safe is of the same time period that this robbery happened, which was 1899. The safe was blown apart. The safe was found in that area where the train was actually held up. So we can't say, yep, that's the safe that Butch blew, but boy, if nothing else, it sure is a great piece in our exhibit. It just shows you how massive these safes were. The Wilcox train robbery, of course, was a pretty famous one. Butch had been robbing banks. He was going to later rob the Tipton train. Tipton was west of Rawlins. But the Wilcox train robbery is near Rock River, Wyoming, north of Laramie. And the reason it's so famous is because the men flagged down this train. They boarded the train. They used dynamite to blow the safe and in the process destroyed the entire baggage car and much of the train itself. That is true. So in the movie, when you see them blowing up and Sundance looks at Butch and goes, did you use enough dynamite there, Butch? That's true. That did happen. And Butch did know how to use dynamite because in his early days, he worked in the mining fields in Colorado and the gold mines there. He was experienced with dynamite. When they did the Tipton train robbery just a year later, in fact, just almost a year later, he uses dynamite again and blows the thing to smithereens as well. But here's the interesting thing about the Wilcox train robbery. In that safe, they got away with about $50,000, but that $50,000 was meant for payment of American troops fighting in the Spanish-American War. In other words, this was a crime committed against the U.S. government. That absolutely pushes him into America's most wanted at that point. President McKinley states that's it. He hires the Pinkerton detective agencies along with the U.S. Marshals to take all steps necessary to apprehend the bandits. And so they began this massive manhunt after Butch at that point.
When we come back,
you know, we can talk about the fate of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid because it is very unique.
The ultimate fate of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, right after this.
Geeks, nerds, devotees of all worlds, lend me your ears. A community of inclusion and passion awaits you at oneofus.net. Movie and music reviews, debates on books and beer, deep dives into comics and games. There's something for everyone because everyone loves something. Podcasts post daily with subscriptions. You get video content as well. All are welcome because in this world of fandom and fanaticism, all of us are in this together. Your love of pop culture and entertainment makes you one of us already. So join us today at oneofus.net.
We are the Wyoming Territorial Prison, and we are located, of course, in Laramie. Our prison here was actually a U.S. federal prison, and it started in 1872. It was a federal penitentiary from 1872 until Wyoming became a state in 1890. So it was a United States penitentiary and Wyoming's first state penitentiary. For 30 years, it held both men and women in its prison population. So when visitors come to the museum today, they're going to learn of punishment and rehabilitation, as well as discover stories, you know, held within the iron cells and behind the prison walls through prisoner identities. There's also a prison industries building, which is the famous broom factory. This was an actual industry that was done here. It was used to raise revenue to manage the prison population, and it was also used as a rehabilitative strategy. We just did an entire exhibit that goes into more depth of what the highlights we were talking about here at the Territorial Prison. Anybody that really likes Butch Cassidy and his story and his intrigue, because there's so much going on at this time. You know, we talk about the Pinkertons in the exhibit and the Union Pacific and the Johnson County Cattle Wars. All that's going on during this Butch's robberies going up and down the Outlaw Trail. We're located on 197 acres, and we offer historic buildings, museum exhibits, and all of the above. We have, of course, COVID restrictions. We ask that everybody wear a mask in our buildings because in the prison, the hallways are, you know, very narrow. So we ask that everyone do that. But we are open in the winter time. We're open year-round, actually. But in our winter hours, our Wednesday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., we sell our last ticket at 2. And then in May, we'll go to our summer operating hours, which will be open every day from 9 to 4. Come see the exhibit. It's well worth it. You'll learn a little bit more about his time here in our prison, about his early beginnings. It's a fun exhibit to immerse yourself in.
All right, Matt. So the end of this movie, like I said, there's a tonal shift that happens here. And the stakes get real high and the mood almost gets somber is not necessarily the right word, but definitely the joking is done more to cope than it is to actually entertain the audience.
They made kind of an interesting decision, and in keeping with its era and its rating, this is not actually a particularly violent movie. There is a lot of, like, the shot gentleman will collapse behind a parapet with his hand over his chest. It's light on the blood and the gore. The end of this ends with a siege, and ultimately they go, and the Bolivians go and get basically the army and bring like a literal battalion of people, like an uncountable, they could not carry enough ammo to kill this many men on foot. They surround the building they're in. Butch and Sundance kind of, they've both been hit already, and they kind of decide they don't want to go into some random Bolivian jail with a bullet in them, and they just opt for the frontal assault. And then we have a freeze frame, and we hear the Bolivian commander give the order in Spanish to fire. And then we hear five or six flights of gunshots. But we don't see the down mowing. We don't see the bodies, you know. So in comic book logic, they got away. They floated downstream and someone woke them up, you know.
Redford and Newman were a favorite of my mother as well. She was a big fan of The Sting. But she loved this movie, but she hated the end. Because these two charming figures, it's implied that they're killed. And it is just kind of a weird, dark punctuation to this movie. But if you pay attention to that theme of the slow progress of technology and the times catching up to them and the Old West not being the Old West anymore, it makes a lot of sense. There is to contend with the actual historicity of what happened.
Well, I don't know. I guess opinions vary about that, don't they?
Well, I tend to be a pessimist about it. Everything I've read, which isn't much, but for what it's worth, it seems to point that Sundance and Butch died in South America, if not at the reported historical shootout, maybe while getting crosswise with some locals over a payroll or something. My gut tells me that they died in South America. How about you?
Upon watching it, I guess it could be expressed through the montage when they're arriving in Bolivia. But in real life, Butch, Sundance, Etta, and I believe they went semi-straight and ran a ranch in Bolivia for almost 10 years. It was not this continuous escalation of bank robberies until this happened. They took a break, given that they had some property, they probably had some community connections, and they were very, they were charming, and they came in with a lot of capital. I mean, there is a world where, and there are a lot of theories that they maybe paid a coroner or a local alcalde or something to put the deaths of some other less luminary robbers down as them and rode off into the sunset somehow. There are some conspiracy theories, and a lot of people believe that either Butch or Butch and Sundance made it out alive.
There are a lot of theories, and as a matter of fact, our guest, Deborah Cease, is one of those people who has a little hope that they made it. But one thing is for certain, though.
Well, I can tell you right now, today, in 2021, they're dead somewhere. That's what I can tell ya. You know, we can talk about the fate of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid because it is very unique. Butch realizes that the law is closing in on him. And, you know, Butch is the last of the horseback outlaws. Let's face it, technology is just surrounding him. You've got the telegraph. You have the beginning of the telephone. You've got the railroad coming in. I mean, you can have a posse at a railroad robbery site within a matter of less than a day if you needed to. And so Butch and Sundance decide, we're out of here. We're going to South America. We need to get away from here. He appeared to many as someone who could not be defeated, captured, or killed. Even the Pinkerton detective agencies, when we were looking at their historical documents, they quoted in their letter that Butch Cassidy was a mastermind criminal because he knew how to evade capture because of his careful planning and his network of friends and all of that. But technology pushed him out of the United States. So he goes down to South America. They try to go straight. They try to do a little bit of a farm ranch type thing down there. But eventually they, along with Etta Place, rob a bank that's down there. And the Pinkertons find out about it, send all this information. Here's where the controversy happens. It's these two American fugitive bank and train robbers are in South America. The Pinkerton detective agencies contact all of the authorities in the area, send them their photos, tell them their aliases, told them be careful because they were considered armed and dangerous. There was a huge reward out for these guys at this point. Everybody was on the lookout. Two individuals robbed this mining payroll in this place outside of San Vicente in Bolivia. They're in this amazing countryside. Two people rob this mining payroll. They kill the guy. They steal the mining company's mule with the brand on the hip and the payroll, and they ride into the small town of San Vicente, and they hide out in a house with one door. That doesn't sound like Butch to me. But what they say is they surround the building, a gunfight erupts, and in the morning the bandits were found. Supposedly Butch had shot Sundance and then committed suicide rather than surrender. Another version is that Butch always had an escape route planned, and he was too clever to get trapped. Therefore, the 1908 shootout that involved two outlaws were deliberately misidentified, providing Butch and Sundance a new life. So the controversy is, did he die in South America? Did he return to the United States? Historians and citizens have relentlessly debated the circumstances around this outlaw's death. And unfortunately, when there's gaps in history, those gaps have to be filled by legend. Because there is no definitive ending, the legend persists. That's the allure of Butch and Sundance's story. There's no ending to it. We don't have, like the James Boys, you've got their bodies, you know, the Younger Gang, you've got their bodies. You've got these bad boys, you've caught them. Butch and Sundance literally disappear into history, and we really don't know what happened to them. In fact, the two outlaws that they found in San Vicente, in that one house, later on, much later, they buried them in San Vicente Cemetery. And later on, scientific DNA, here not too long ago, was done on those two remains, and they are not. They have DNA evidence that those two bodies that are claimed to be buried in San Vicente Cemetery is not Butch and Sundance. So where are they?
All right, Matt. Any final thoughts before we wrap up on our discussion of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, 1969, from George Roy Hill and writer William Goldman?
I got to say, for all the things that are supposed to be set in Wyoming, a lot of things have stood in for Wyoming over the years. Colorado,
New Mexico,
parts of California, New Mexico,
Canada, Utah.
But I will say, this definitely, it's a little green, but this does look like it could be shot, you know, somewhere south of Casper.
Mm-hmm.
As long as the elevation was up a little higher than maybe you and I are used to. It's a nice movie. It's not so childish that it's a kid's movie. It's not so dark that it's depressing. It's that proverbial four quadrant movie. It's got romance, it's got action, it's got quippy dialogue, and it's got scenery. No wonder the British were taken with it, you know? It won every BAFTA it was nominated for. Nine
wow.
of them.
Way to go, so, Butch and Sundance.
They took England by storm. They're huge overseas.
I did want to shout out to the Crook County Museum and 1875 Gallery in Wyoming. Obviously, they're in Crook County. They are where Sundance earned his name in jail. And they have a neat statue of the Sundance kid sitting in his cell that's a great photo op for people passing through the area. At the time of this recording, the museum is currently closed and undergoing some remodeling and relocation, but information is available at sundancewyoming.com. Matt, do you want to send us off for the evening?
Sure. Shake the popcorn off your lap and be sure to deposit all trash in the bins provided near the entrance, because dawn is breaking at the old Jackalope Drive-In.
Folks, thanks for tuning in to this special presentation of the Nighthawks podcast. Please subscribe to us on the podcatcher of your choosing. And if you have the option to rate and review the show on services like Audible and Apple Podcasts, you'd be doing us a heck of a kindness by leaving a review and rating. More animatic content is coming soon for our video fans that will be posted to our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram pages. Otherwise, folks, have a safe and pleasant evening. Take care out there, because it's almost morning.
Hey everybody, I'm Alan Barber.
And I'm Kirk Klinger.
And we are the hosts of a podcast called You've Never Heard This.
You've Never Heard This?
You've Never Heard This. It's been brought to our attention by the wonderful hosts of the Nighthawks podcast that we use the word new in our promo that they so graciously play on every episode.
And we are not new, Alan.
We are not new. We are no spring chickens.
We're not.
We've been doing this a while.
We've been around. Doesn't mean we know what we're doing.
No, not at all. But we certainly like to pretend.
We try.
If you love music, then yes, you'll love this podcast. It's like a book club, except you don't have to do the homework.
Absolutely.
And we hope that you will join us talking about everything from Soundgarden to Billie Eilish to the Dresden Dolls to Korn.
Little of everything, really.
Little bit of everything.
We have fun.
We do. We have a good time. So we hope that you will join us. Enjoy our podcast. We can be found on just about every platform you can think of. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, most recently, Amazon Music and Audible.
Nice.
You have no excuse to not find us.
Yes. So you've never heard us.
Every Tuesday.
So check out
the podcast.
You've never heard this.
Enjoy.
Hey, everybody. I'm Matt Foster.
And I'm Trevor T. Trujillo.
And we're the co-hosts of a podcast called The Nighthawks Podcast.
You've never heard The Nighthawks?
Oh, I've heard The Nighthawks. It's been brought to our attention by Kirk and Alan at the wonderful You've Never Heard This podcast that the Nighthawks promos they run on their show are old.
They're not new.
They are not new. They are no spring chickens.
No, they're not.
They've been running a while.
They've been around.
That doesn't mean they're not working.
I don't know what we're doing.
No, not at all. But we certainly like to pretend.
We try.
If you love movies, then you'll love the Nighthawks podcast.
It's like a book club, but for movies, and you can pick whether you do the homework or not.
It won't change our conversation a bit if you don't.
We hope that you'll join us talking about everything from Citizen Kane to Indiana Jones to Friday the 13th to Sunset Boulevard to the Bill and Ted trilogy.
Aw, a little bit of everything, really.
A little bit of everything.
We have fun.
We do. We have a good time.
If we don't, they put leeches on us.
So we hope that you will join us and enjoy our podcast.
We can be found on just about every platform you can think of. Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Audible.
Nice.
You have no excuse not to find us.
If you've never heard us, take this promo on You've Never Heard This as your mission.
Your call to action.
Your quest.
Your raison d'etre.
Check out the Nighthawks podcast.
Enjoy.
Before I knew I had it, BPD was just a framework of patterns I'd been subconsciously repeating for nearly 19 years, making my life feel like a daily struggle at best, or at worst, impulsive and dangerous. Back from the Borderline is the story of one girl's recovery from BPD. I'm Molly. I struggled with symptoms of borderline personality disorder, depression, and anxiety since late adolescence. After my BPD diagnosis, I decided to make it my life's mission to become an emotional grown-up. This marked the beginning of a journey of self-discovery and research that resulted in massive mindset shifts. The more I learned, the less control my BPD symptoms had over my life.
All you have to do is Google search borderline personality disorder and you'll see the diagnostic criteria. It's laid all out in black and white, but the thing is, BPD is anything but black and white. It's 10,000 shades of gray. What I found myself craving more than anything after my diagnosis were resources and content that made me feel seen, heard, and less alone. I wanted desperately to discover and consume more diverse perspectives and stories from others with BPD that I could really relate to. There's a lot of negative, stigmatized, and downright false information out there about people with BPD. It's easy to start to feel like the best outcome you can aim for is to survive. It's really easy to lose hope. What's written about a lot less is how it actually feels to have borderline personality disorder, being unable to connect with other human beings because the belief at our very core is that we're worthless and shameful, this sick and twisted cycle of living in constant fear of abandonment while continuing to act in ways that push people away from us, being utterly terrified of being left alone with our own thoughts and emotions, changing our appearance, personality, and ideas with the wind with no tangible anchor of morals and values to help us stand firm in who we are. A chameleon. A shell. This is our reality. And that reality is really difficult for the DSM to accurately convey. 2 years ago, I decided to reject that reality. I decided that I would cure myself of the symptoms of this disorder no matter what it took. I decided I wanted to find out who I actually was underneath all this pain. This podcast is for anyone struggling directly or indirectly with the effects of BPD or emotional dysregulation. Each week, we'll meet right here. Based on where I'm at in my recovery process, I'll share stories from my past, things I'm currently struggling with, books and resources that have changed the game for me, and conversations with inspiring people. Some of these people will be my friends and family. Some of them will be people whose work has contributed to massive leaps forward in my recovery, and I hope they'll do the same for you. I see you. I know where you've been. But where we're going is even better. In the spirit of being authentic, let's just get one thing out of the way. I will make mistakes while making this podcast for you. I'm gonna get some things wrong. Keep in mind that Back from the Borderline is not a substitute for professional, mental, or medical treatment of BPD. I am not a psychiatrist, a therapist, or a doctor. I'm just a regular person sharing my personal recovery journey. I only need you to do one thing before you go. Subscribe to the podcast so you'll know each time I drop a new episode. I'll be serving up all the tips, tricks, and vulnerable conversations you'll need to deepen and expand your own recovery process as you join me in mine. You're not alone. Together, we'll pursue a life free from BPD. Back from the Borderline is the story of one girl's recovery from BPD. I'm Molly.